The Fire Next Time was James Baldwin's powerful book published in 1963. It includes his letter to his nephew James, and you heard part of that letter when our music director Tony McDonald read it earlier. Now Tony returns to read more from Baldwin's book, and Faith Van Horn reads from a 2016 book edited by Jesmyn Ward, The Fire This Time. Ward, inspired by Baldwin's 1963 book and impelled by the events of the last few years, gathered a group of black writers who contributed essays and poems. So when Tony reads, you're hearing James Baldwin in mid-20th century warning of the fire next time. When Faith reads, you're hearing the voices of black Americans from 2016, Kevin Young, Isabel Wilkerson, Wendy S. Walters, and Edwidge Danticat. The 21st century telling us about the fire this time. Spanning more than 50 years, these voices of past, present, and future offer us not just their pain, but also their insight and their hope. Tony.
Dear James, this innocent country set you down in a ghetto in which, in fact, it intended that you should perish. You were born into a society which spelled out with brutal clarity and in as many ways as possible that you are a worthless human being.
Some things are just part of the daily dose of being black. The cab will drive away with a white friend in it rather than drive you too. Racism's daily injustices are almost an inoculation against it. Almost.
Please try to remember that what white people believe, as well as what they do and cause you to endure, does not testify to your inferiority, but to their fear.
So when the killer walked into Mother Emmanuel Church in Charleston, I am not surprised that the black worshipers there welcomed him. Welcome is an integral part of the African American Christian tradition. How long did he sit there waiting, deciding to deny the evidence of the humanity before him? Nothing, it appears, could have convinced him not to kill blacks whom he believed preyed on white people, especially women.
You must accept them, and accept them with love, for these innocent people have no other hope. They are, in effect, still trapped in a history which they do not understand. And until they understand it, they cannot be released from it.
We seem to be in a continuing feedback loop of repeating a past that our country has yet to address. The past few months have forced us to confront our place in a country where we were enslaved for far longer than we have been free. The loss of black lives at the hands of authorities does not so much as merit further inquiry. From this, we have learned that the journey is far from over.
I have said that it was intended that you should perish in the ghetto, perish by never being allowed to go behind the white man's definitions. You have, and many of us have, defeated this intention. And by a terrible paradox, those innocents who believed that your imprisonment made them safe are losing their grasp of reality. These men are your brothers, your lost younger brothers. And if the word integration means anything, this is what it means, that we, with love, shall force our brothers to see themselves as they are, to cease fleeing from reality and to begin to change it. Real change requires most radical and far-reaching changes in the American political and social structure. White Americans are not simply unwilling to affect these changes. They are, in the main, unable even to envision them.
When a story is unpleasant, it is hard to focus on the details that allow you to put yourself in the place of the subject. Paying attention requires empathy, but empathy these days is hard to come by. Maybe this is because everyone is having such a hard time being understood themselves, or because empathy requires us to dig way down into the murk, deeper than our own feelings go, to a place where boundaries between our experience and everyone else's no longer exist.
Love takes off the masks that we fear we cannot live without and know we cannot live within. I use the word love here in the tough and universal sense of quest and daring and growth. We, the black and the white, deeply need each other if we are really to become a nation, if we are really, that is, to achieve our identity, our maturity as men and women.
We must know our history to gain strength for the days ahead. We must love ourselves even if, and perhaps especially if, others do not. We must keep our faith even as we work to make our country live up to its creed.
Everything now, we must assume, is in our hands. If we, the relatively conscious whites and the relatively conscious blacks, do not falter in our duty, we may be able, handful that we are, to end the racial nightmare and achieve our country and change the history of the world.
To my draft of this letter to my daughters, I often add snippets of Baldwin. I tell you this because I love you, and please don't you ever forget it, Baldwin reminded his James. The world is before you. I want to tell my daughters, and you need not take it or leave it as it was when you came in.
My parents raised me well. But race is socially constructed. I learned racist assumptions despite my parents' best efforts. I learned the assumptions that they didn't and couldn't know that they were making. They taught me to respect every human being. They taught me not to judge people based on skin color or national origin, ethnic background, or religious tradition. They lived these teachings in their own lives. And yet, race is socially constructed. Whatever the color of our skin, black, white, warm brown tones, tan, whatever our hair, whatever our eyes, however we may appear, we breathe in like air society's structural racism. So just think for a minute about the reactions that some of these phrases evoke. Black neighborhood, inner city school, young black man. Race is not a genetic thing. It is socially constructed, And those social constructions have power only so long as, first, we don't know about them, then they have tremendous power. Or second, even if we know about them, we still act as if they're true. And I know this. I know this because I have lived this in my own life. And so I want to say just a word about that word racist. I don't like that word. It's a finger-pointing word, name-calling. We teach our children not to call other children names. It seems like there are a lot of grown-ups who haven't figured that out. And there are racist statements and assumptions, of course, and behaviors and racist social structures. And yes, there are racists. I know this because I am a racist. That is, I'm constantly twitching to the direction of my unspoken yet culturally embedded assumptions about race. So, waking up. I chose this picture because it's a picture of a woman sitting in the morning with a cup of coffee, the morning sun shining, and she seems to be reflecting. This is what I've been doing in the years since I reached adulthood, maybe before. I have been woke to the realities of race as a social construction, to the assumptions that our society embeds in its institutions and its laws. And each time I think I am finally awake, and then I wake up again. So more than one morning I sat like that reflecting, maybe after the children have gotten to school, holding my coffee, warming my hands on the cup, and thinking, awake again. How many times can this happen? I can't even count. Before I had children, I woke up a little because I went to law school, and understanding the law helped me see the ways that our society's institutions and structures disadvantage and hinder people of color. But if I am now well and truly woke, and I'm certainly not sure that I am, it was my children who woke me. Let's have the pictures of Jamie. Yes, this is my daughter, Jamie, at 4 years old and about 7 years old. She's Korean American, adopted. She came from Korea, so she's also an immigrant. As she, in an annoyed tone of voice, frequently comments, "So I can't be president of the United States." And believe me, that is really a shame because she would be terrific. At age four, the age she is about in this picture, I picked her up from preschool, and she was unusually silent. She got in the car, and she burst into tears. She said, "The other girls won't let me be Cinderella." I said, "What? Why? I thought they were your friends." She said, "They say I can't be Cinderella because I don't have black hair. I don't have blonde hair." It was her black hair that barred her from being Cinderella when they played together. Little girls understood that. You can't be Cinderella if your hair isn't blonde. And then Jamie at age six, she loved dolls. I found it slightly terrifying how much she loved dolls because I knew, you know, especially the Barbie dolls were not the kind of images I wished her to have about her body. But the one that surprised me, so I woke up. Just a little. She said, I want an American girl doll that looks like me. Of course she did. Of course. And at the time, there were not any Asian American girl dolls. Now it's changed. There are lots of dolls with lots of different ethnicities. All of them actually look a little white. But you can find them. Although, as we heard in our story this morning, and that, believe me, is a true story, you can go online. The information is in your order of service to locate the mom who encouraged and supported Lola in writing her letter to Target. It's a true story. Despite the fact that these dolls are now available, they're not always there in the store. And you know, it's not only so that children like my little Jamie can play with a doll that looks like her, but it's so that children who are white, or whatever their ethnicity, can have a range of dolls and play with all of them. Jamie, at age 7, this was just after our trip to Paris, was in Indonesia with me for a month. And on the way, when we arrived, on the way from the airport to the hotel, riding in the taxi, she had her face pressed against the window, looking out in amazement at all the people. And she said to me, Mom, remember how you've always told me that there are more brown and black people in the world than there are white people, and that most of the people in the world are brown and black? I said, yes, Jamie, and that's true. She said, well, until we came here, I didn't really believe you. Whiteness is the norm. I woke up a little bit. Whiteness is the norm. And Jamie at age 8, so just a little older than in this picture, as we were going through the process of adopting my son Kevin, and we were talking with the adoption counselor together, because I decided Jamie really needed to be a part of this process. We didn't have a dad in our family. I was adopting Kevin as a single parent. So I didn't want to just do it. I wanted to make sure Jamie was engaged. And so Jamie, in this conversation with the adoption counselor, stated clearly and emphatically, believe me, as clearly and emphatically as Lola said in her letter to Target, she said she wanted a sibling, boy or girl, with brown or tan skin, because, she said, I don't want to be a minority in my own family. Duh. But it hadn't occurred to me until that moment that, of course, she should not be the only person of color in our family. And so I said, yes, yes, we want to adopt a child of color. And the adoption counselor said that that might be a challenge, but in just a few weeks, we learned that there was a woman who was likely to give birth to a child of color, and that we might be able to adopt that baby when the child was born. So we had our fingers crossed that this might be just the right thing for our family. And so I was having dinner that same evening with other law professors. I was a law professor at the time, and I was just bursting with happiness, unable not to tell them about this great news, my decision to adopt a child, and the fact that it looked as if we were going to be able to have a child with tan or brown skin. One of the dinner guests said, apropos of nothing, I just don't understand why those people can't use birth control. That was the first response to my wonderful news. Those people. Kevin's birth mother is white, And she did use birth control. You know, it's not as effective when you're taking antibiotics. I once pointed out to my mother that 60% of her 10 grandchildren, 6 out of 10, were conceived out of wedlock. She said, I guess you're right. You know, my siblings are all white. So those people. Young Kevin. So here he is at about age, about age 9, and here he is at 10, and here he is at maybe 11. That's his bassoon, and of course he loved martial arts. He was always striking these poses. Now, baby Kevin was another opportunity for me to wake up. Everything went very well, very smoothly, and we bonded with this baby right away. And when he was a week old, my mom came out to be with us and to help me out and to get to know her new grandson. We were so excited. And we were having lunch in a restaurant with the baby, you know, in a stroller, sleeping, as babies that age do. Kevin was very good at that age at sleeping. And as Mom and I were starting to order and having lunch, we started to hear a conversation that was going on at a table right next to us that had three or four, I would have described them then as elderly ladies, white ladies, who were having lunch. And the conversation was about whether that baby, my baby, was a Negro. Well, now, Kevin, when he was born, was kind of a deep pink, and he was bald. So to look at him, you might think, oh, white baby. Especially looking at him and two white women are sitting with him, obviously the mom and the grandmom. But the ladies were talking about, no, a lot of babies who are black, who are Negro, they use the terms pretty interchangeably. They start out looking like that. And when the hair comes in, it'll be kinky. But sometimes it takes a few months for it to get kinky. Sometimes it comes in sort of soft and fine. So that's a black baby. They were talking about us as if we weren't there. They were talking not about us, actually. They were talking about this baby, my baby. And they didn't seem to have any idea that they were talking loud enough for us to hear. In fact, it seemed as if they really didn't care whether we heard. It was shattering to realize that there was that level of, I don't know, callousness maybe, about my feelings and addressed to a baby, that level of concern about the child's race. But there was a new thing that also happened when Kevin was a baby and in his stroller. A new thing. The white ladies ignored me, but black people did not. When they saw me pushing Kevin in his stroller, they met my eyes and they smiled. And I smiled back. And this was new. I woke up a little then because I realized walking down the street, I'd never met the eyes of black people before. I'd never looked at them and smiled. I'd never really seen them. So I went along in my newfound excitement. It was like being part of a society, a secret society I hadn't known existed. Suddenly, there were all these people who welcomed me and my baby. And I was incredibly grieved and sad that I hadn't looked at them before. Kevin, at age 4, wore little red boots everywhere, even to bed. They smelled terrible, but he was so cute. And at age, when he was about 4, we went to the Maryland Science Center in Baltimore, and he was so excited that we were going to visit the kids' room at the Science Center that he skipped ahead, going to the entrance of the kids' center, and the white guard who was at the door said, "Hold it right there. Where do you think you're going?" Entrance to the kids' room, 4-year-old kid. And so I saw this happen. The guard obviously didn't think I had any connection with this little black kid. So I stepped up and I said, "Is there a problem, officer?" You know that voice. "Is there a problem, officer?" This is the exercise of white privilege I now see. I didn't know it at the time. It was just what I did. And the officer said, "No, ma'am." I said, "This is my son." He said, "Go right in." It was disheartening, to say the least. So while Kevin was skipping around in his red boots and discovering science, growing a little bit older, my daughter was in high school, and she took Black History. She had a wonderful experience in that Black History course. It was a great eye-opener for her and for me. She began to make sense of her own experience in this world by reading Malcolm X. And she, at the dinner table, read this out loud to me, read long quotes out loud to me about what Malcolm X said and why it was right. And wow, you know, it was tough. Tough. I had to learn in a new way about Malcolm X. And one of the things she said is that some people should just have a tattoo across their forehead that says, "Mean white girl." Yeah. Now, we had an experience in Cambridge, Massachusetts. I was walking on the street with Kevin, and he was about 4. And we're walking down the sidewalk, and a young black man was walking toward us. And I had that experience that so many white people, especially white women, have. I thought, young black man might be dangerous. And I was holding my son's hand. And he was going to be right between us as this young black man came. And I thought, am I endangering my child by walking down this sidewalk? And I decided that there wasn't anything that I could do and that it would probably be okay. So I kept on walking. And as we passed, without any encouragement or instruction or anything, the young black man, this cool dude, and Kevin reached out their hands and they slapped palms. High five. And then I realized that there was another secret society, that Kevin apparently was already part of a world about which I had almost no understanding. That at 4 years old, he knew to do that. He knew this was a cool black dude. He knew he was a cool black dude. So it was another one of those wake-up calls. There were so many. In high school, Jamie's Latino boyfriend was told by his math teacher that he had to retake a test because he'd done too well on it. And he wasn't smart enough to be able to do so well, so he had to take a new test all alone in the room. Jamie waited for him while he took the test. And he did just as well on the new test as he'd done on the old test. But the experience hurt so much that when they came home and told me about it, they both cried. I cried. It hurt so much to be judged inferior. When Kevin was 7, so a little younger than in that picture on your left, he went with me to Ethiopia. Again, another experience where my child could see that there are actually more brown and black-skinned people in the world than white people. But there, I had to explain to Kevin the difference between, well, he asked the question, why is it that we're staying in this beautiful hotel, which is filled entirely with white people, except the people who are serving in the hotel, and just outside the exterior wall, people who have dark skin are living in shacks. Mom, he said, they don't even have floors in those houses. He wanted to know why. I discovered then that to explain not only the extremes of poverty and wealth, but also the allocation of wealth, I had to explain corporate exploitation of less developed countries. He was 7. He got it. Kevin had so many good times. Let's have the other slide, please. This is Kevin with some of his friends, I think in about 8th grade. Like Thurgood Marshall said in 1953, kids play together. Kids of all races play together. It's what they do. And so Kevin was fortunate in that he always had good friends of all races, religions, and ethnic backgrounds. But you know, race is a social construct, so sometimes kids absorb the worst lessons of our culture. Not any of these boys, but when Kevin was in 4th grade, at the age of 9, a boy in his class called him and the other children of color in the class the N-word and spit on them. Despite the teacher's pleas, her pleas to the principal, and despite my own insistence and efforts, the school did nothing. There was nothing to mark that what this boy had done was beyond the pale, was totally unacceptable. The school did nothing. My child's well-being, and it seemed the well-being of other children of color, didn't matter. So, trained as a lawyer, right? I was a minister then, but you never forget that training. I got in touch with the State Attorney General's Office of Civil Rights, and another mom of a child in that class got in touch with the United States Department of Education. Both investigated, both found the school to be at fault. That was something. But the next year, the first day of school, Kevin came home trembling with shock because he and that child had been placed in the same class, which was part of our agreement. Was that that would not happen. Because Kevin was so afraid. James Baldwin, writing to his nephew, said, "There you were. You were here, here to be loved, baby, hard at once and forever, to strengthen you against the loveless world." Kevin was trembling, and so was I. I love that baby. I love that boy. I love that young man. With Kevin and Jamie growing up, did we talk about racism at the dinner table? We didn't usually call it that, but we did talk about it every night because the experiences that flow from the social construction of race were always present in answer to my question, how was your day? Always. We trembled. Sometimes we wept. If we had not loved each other, none of us would have survived. When Kevin was 12, we got a black dog. Ah, there they are. It was clearly going to be Kevin's dog. And he said, "Finally, there's someone in my family who looks like me." When Kevin was growing up, one of the things he did was get to know police officers. And he liked them. Some of them were my friends. Some of them were friendly just because we lived in a small town and everybody knew him and knew that I was his mom. And when Kevin was 10, I heard from a police officer that Kevin and his buddy each took a candy bar from the corner store. The officer knew that I would walk Kevin back into the store and make him pay for it and let him know he was never to do that again. And then again, when Kevin was 15, he was with his friends in the park, and I heard from a police officer that Kevin was there with the other teens when police confiscated their marijuana. Now, it wasn't a criminal offense in Massachusetts at that time, but the police were allowed to take the marijuana away. And the officer said to me, "Your son was calm and very polite, and he didn't have any marijuana." And I thought to myself, not that time. But then we moved to a real city, and Kevin was 17, and he was walking the dog, the same black dog, in our racially diverse neighborhood in an attractive and older residential section of Kansas City, Missouri. A patrol car stopped him, and the police officers questioned him about what he was doing in the neighborhood. And of course, he said, "You know, I'm walking my dog." He was wearing his hoodie. Yeah, of course he was. Most of the time, he wears his hoodie. "Walking the dog," he said, "and I live across the street." One of the officers, who was a Latino man, asked, "How do we know that you're not casing the neighborhood and planning a break-in?" Now, Kevin is pretty mellow. He said, "Really? A break-in? Look at me. I'm wearing flip-flops. Who cases a neighborhood wearing flip-flops?" And the officers moved on. These aren't the droids we're looking for. But you know, it could have been so much worse. That was the year that Trayvon Martin was killed while walking in his own neighborhood and wearing his suspicious, dangerous hoodie. "I love you, baby. You must survive because I love you." James Baldwin told his nephew, "What white people cause you to endure does not testify to your inferiority, but to their fear." I think about police officers and what they may fear. Young black man, dangerous. Just exactly what I thought about that cool dude in Cambridge when Kevin was 4. Any move becomes a threatening one. But we can change. Our society can change. I have changed. I think now that I have spent my whole life waking up again and again. Walking alone by myself in Portland last year, I was mildly lost. A young black man with long dreads was valet parking cars in front of a restaurant, and I smiled at him, thinking how much he looked like my son. He smiled back. He gave me directions. Only later did I realize that I hadn't been afraid. It's more than just not being afraid. It's seeing the world differently. I'm the mother of two children of color. I don't think about it like that. It just is. They're my babies. Next slide, please. They are on the left with one grandfather, on the right with the man they think of as a grandfather. There they are now, close to their current ages. They're my babies. I'm their mama. I'm the eyes behind the camera. And my eyes love what I see when I look at them. I think it comes through in this picture. And it shapes how I experience the world. Just in April, I was walking by myself at night, late at night, in Newark, New Jersey, walking from the train station to my hotel. A couple of young black men walked towards me. They were tall and handsome, like my son. I guess I was looking at them and smiling. They smiled at me, and one of them said, "Have a good evening, Mama." So yes, I'm Mama now. I guess they know that look, that Mama look. The look that says, "Baby, I love you, and you must survive because I love you." Waking up. Love takes off the masks. It invites us to pause, to hold back the unthinking, knee-jerk, culturally embedded fear reaction. Love invites us to open the heart, to open the heart to the real human being in front of us. Love. Love invites us to wake up every day and for the rest of our lives.
We are here together, seeking to transform our own lives and the life of the world. We study, we struggle to learn and grow. But we don't wait for all that growth to occur